They were supposed to stop conflict in eastern Ukraine, but the Minsk agreements have been repeatedly violated since 2015. With the threat of a Russian invasion, can the accord still provide a path to peace? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Mohammed Jamjoum. Political leaders and diplomats say they're working hard to prevent a Russian invasion of Ukraine. The so-called Minsk agreements keep coming up in their discussions. They were signed in Belarus to try and secure a ceasefire between Ukrainian government forces and Russian-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine. The first version in 2014 failed to take hold, so a second accord, called Minsk II, was signed the following year. But both sides accuse each other of breaking the agreement. At least 14,000 people have been killed in fighting during the past 8 years. Monitors from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE, have reported hundreds of ceasefire violations a day. Despite this, many diplomats insist the Minsk agreements are the only way forward to secure peace.
The Minsk agreements remain the only framework endorsed by this Council in Resolution 2202 for a negotiated peaceful settlement of the conflict in eastern Ukraine.
Kyiv doesn't comply with the Minsk agreements, refuses to establish a direct dialogue with Donetsk and Luhansk, undermines the agreements to introduce changes in the constitution, the exclusive statute of Donbass, local elections and the amnesty, all key issues of the Minsk agreements.
Regarding the possible recognition of the so-called Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics by the Russian Duma, I would like to remind once again of the Ukrainian position, which has never changed. If recognition is approved, Russia will exit the Minsk agreements de facto and according to the law as well, with all the consequences to come.
The Minsk II agreement contains 13 points. 9 are designed to end the armed conflict in Ukraine, while the other 4 address the political impasse between Kyiv and the pro-Russia rebels. The agreement calls for the removal of heavy weapons, hostage exchanges, release of political prisoners, and the pullout of all foreign armed groups. It also sets a roadmap for political dialogue. This includes giving the Donetsk and Luhansk regions some devolved powers and holding elections there. But Russia wants special status for the regions before returning the border to Kyiv's control. Russia maintains it was only a facilitator and not part of the conflict inside Ukraine, so it is not bound by the terms of the agreement. All right, let's bring in our guests. In Moscow, Andrei Kortunov, Director General of the Russian International Affairs Council. In Kyiv, Mykhailo Vinetsky, Associate Professor of Sociology at National University of Kyiv, Kyiv Mohyla Academy. In Istanbul, Matthew Bryza, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and former National Security Council official at the White House. A warm welcome to you all, and thanks so much for joining us today on Inside Story. Mykhailo, let me start with you. Why haven't the Minsk agreements worked, and what are the problems inherent in them?
Well, there's one very simple thing that is in the Minsk agreements that was agreed to in the first Minsk and the second Minsk, that Russian troops must leave Ukrainian soil. Simple as that. Until such time as Russian troops have not left Ukrainian soil, there is very little to talk about with respect to Minsk. There's a requirement for local elections. There's a requirement for changing the constitution, etc. But none of that can be done until such time as that territory is occupied by Russian forces. And today to talk about Minsk is, quite frankly, completely, ludicrous, because we have almost 200,000 troops at our borders expected to be invading the rest of Ukraine anytime soon. So, I mean, quite frankly, Minsk is, well, effectively dead, and it was put, it was basically killed by the Kremlin when it decided to ignore the basics of the agreement, and that was to withdraw Russian troops.
Andrei, by most accounts, the Minsk agreements essentially were dead on arrival. They have not worked. From your perspective, Can they be reworked? Can they be modified in a way that the process would work going forward? And if so, how?
Well, I think that realistically, we should probably focus on the so-called military package within the Minsk agreements, which implies the first 3 points of the agreements signed 7 years ago. First of all, stable and verifiable ceasefire. Second, withdrawal of heavy weapons. Third, strengthening OSCE monitoring missions in Donbas. If we are able to comply with the first 3 points of the Minsk agreements, that would already be a very significant progress. Later on, we can move to the political agenda, which will probably have to be modified or updated. But of course, that would require consent of all those who signed the initial agreements.
Matthew, there are a lot of diplomats right now that are saying the Minsk agreements are really the only path forward when it comes to trying to de-escalate this crisis. When it comes to the United States, they've had very little involvement in this process. How much can the U.S. get involved now?
Well, probably can't get involved directly in the Minsk group negotiations because at least Russia, France, and Germany, who are the ones that kind of, you know, were the leaders along with Ukraine or the participants, they don't want the U.S. to participate. I think Ukraine would love the U.S. to be involved in the negotiations, but there's not a direct role for the United States. But of course, there's a huge indirect role for the United States, first and foremost by rallying NATO and maintaining its solidarity right now in an attempt to deter further Russian use of military force against Ukraine. And it's important to know that this threat by Russia to use force is a negotiating tactic. It may be a genuine threat to reinvade Ukraine as well. But it's a piece of negotiating leverage, a very important piece. The goal, however, of Russia, I think, is not really to get the Minsk agreements finalized. But of course, Russia's objectives, as articulated by President Putin, are much broader than the Minsk agreement. And they all have to do with pushing back NATO into its pre-1997 borders.
Mikhailo, it looked earlier like you wanted to jump in. I'm going to let you do that. But I also want to ask you, are officials in Kiev worried that the West is going to try to use this Russian threat to strong-arm Ukraine into accepting Moscow's version of the Minsk agreements?
Okay, well, I want to say three things, and I'm going to be very brief about them. First of all, people in Ukraine and officials in Ukraine are worried about being invaded. The West at the moment is helping us, and we are very grateful for the military, economic, and political aid, diplomatic aid that is being provided. And quite frankly, one of the reasons that Putin has not invaded the country en masse yet has to do with the fact that there is Western support. So quite frankly, we're not concerned about the West somehow leaving us dry with this Minsk agreement. At the end of the day, everybody is working towards avoiding a further invasion. The other thing that I wanted to say was to my American colleague, quite frankly, that the goal of Putin is to try to stop NATO, etc. Putin has made it very clear as to what he wants. The whole NATO thing is, quite frankly, just it's a diversion at the end of the day. Putin wants to control Ukraine. Putin wants to reestablish greater Russia. He is the gatherer of the Russian lands. This is what he's about. And Ukraine is something that is an absolute requirement. Trotsky 100 years ago said that Russia cannot exist without Ukraine. And that is something that has continued to be something that is in the Russian mind and in the Russian elite's political agenda for the last 30 years. And quite frankly, now is the time, according to Putin, to try to make that dream a reality. Finally, with respect to the Minsk agreements, we need to understand that these agreements were signed when Putin was holding a gun to Ukraine's head. The first agreement was signed after he was bombarding Mariupol. The second agreement was signed after there were Russian troops on the ground in Ukraine in a place called Debaltseve. In both cases, the goal was to create a ceasefire. That ceasefire has held, basically, plus or minus, has held for the last 5 or 6 years. There's been a line of contact, and that line of contact has had minimal firing across shooting on either side. Mm-hmm. During the last day, we've had over 100 ceasefire violations, and those ceasefire violations have all come from the Russian side. At the end of the day, Ukraine's demand is very simple. Russians, get out of our territory.
Matthew, you were reacting there to some of what Mykhailo was saying. I'm going to let you jump in.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, I agree with everything that Mykhailo said. And, you know, of course, Ukraine is the immediate huge focus of what Putin's trying to do. But there is this broader geostrategic objective as well when Putin talks about the desire for a whole new European security architecture, which I think is going to end up being a proposal that's dead on arrival. But as far as Debaltseve goes, yeah, that's a very important example. Immediately after Minsk II was signed, Russians mounted a major assault on Debaltseve in total violation of the first aspect of the second Minsk agreement, which was a ceasefire, as well as the first Minsk agreement, which was a ceasefire. So from the beginning, Russia has not observed the Minsk agreements. And the contrary, as Mykhailo said, it has kept its military forces in Ukraine on its territory, even if it denies that they're there. It has allowed the illegal armed formations of the Donetsk region to remain in place. Those were supposed to be disbanded. And far from moving heavy military equipment out of Donbas, Russia has massed up to 190,000 troops with heavy equipment near the border. So when Russia demands that Ukraine comes into compliance with the Minsk agreements, well, A, it's not in compliance, and B, if its threat to use military force is supposedly to bring Ukraine into compliance, well, then it doesn't make any sense that Russia still claims not to be a party to those agreements or the conflicts. Why would you threaten to invade a country to enforce an agreement that you claim you're not a party of?
Andrei, earlier this month, there were talks between Ukrainian and Russian officials in the Normandy format, but they really failed to make a breakthrough, correct?
That's right. That's right. There was disappointment expressed by Mr. Kozak, who is a special envoy of President Putin. He argued that he failed to get any flexibility on the Ukrainian side in terms of the Ukrainian compliance with the Minsk agreements.
And do you think that there will be further talks going forward?
Well, I think that if indeed the diplomatic path is something that they would prefer in the Kremlin, this is the only way to go. It seems that my co-panelists from the United States and Ukraine know much better than I do what Putin really wants and what he's up to. Unfortunately, I don't have such great contacts in the Kremlin to make sure that the invasion is imminent and that it's likely to happen anytime soon. However, I would suggest that it's not really logical for Putin to launch a major military operation in Ukraine. It's a lot that Russia can lose. It's not much that Russia can gain. I think it's in the interests of the Kremlin to preserve the pressure on Ukraine and to insist on the full compliance of the Minsk agreements as they were signed 7 years ago. I think that this is the ultimate goal because compliance with the Minsk agreements ultimately might set an obstacle, maybe a strategic obstacle on Ukraine joining the NATO alliance. And this is, I think that this is the goal that Putin is trying to accomplish. If he's able to prevent Ukraine joining NATO through other means, then probably he would demonstrate more flexibility on the implications of the Minsk agreements.
Mykhailo, I can see that you want to jump in. Before you do, I just also want to ask you, do you think that there are going to be more Normandy format talks going forward? And even if there were some type of agreement that were reached, do you think that President Zelensky would actually be able to push this kind of a deal through parliament in Ukraine?
I want to react, first of all, to what my colleague, my Russian colleague said. Very simple. We don't have information as to whether or not there will be an imminent invasion. All we know is that there are 190,000 troops on our borders, and those 190,000 troops are not exactly defensive. Most of them are what's called battalion tactical groups. Those are attack forces, first of all. Secondly, I read the Kremlin website. I listen to what Putin says. And Putin specifically has said, and the website, if you want to, in July, published his musings on the history of Ukraine and Russia and how we are supposedly one people. He has come out many, many times and said that he does not recognize Ukraine's right to exist as a separate country. I am a Ukrainian. I would like to exist. I believe that that is, leaves us very little room for negotiation. When someone is invading you and says that you have no rights to exist, and you are defending yourself and you're saying, I have a right to exist, what is there to negotiate about? It's very much a to be or not to be type of scenario. There's very little to negotiate. Now, yes, we are, of course, interested in having a Normandy format, a U.S. format. President Zelensky has said that he would be very happy to bring in President Erdogan from Turkey into this situation. He has stated yesterday in Munich that he would love to meet with Putin. Putin is not interested in meeting. Putin is interested in destroying. At the end of the day, Ukrainians are preparing to defend themselves. There's very little to talk about at that point when you are at gunpoint. That is the reality at the moment. Kyiv is, I will not say evacuating, but certainly very, very concerned, particularly after President Biden's statement of the fact that Putin has already made his decision. We have seen maps. We have seen troops, troop buildups, and we have listened to what President Putin has to say. And unfortunately, none of that makes us particularly confident in the prospects for peace.
Matthew, what do you think? Do you think there's going to be more of these Normandy format talks going forward? And even if there are, and even if there is some type of agreement that is reached, do you think that it will hold?
Well, I don't anticipate a Normandy format discussion until the current extreme high level of tension decreases. And, you know, what we're seeing right now in eastern Ukraine is exactly what we saw in Georgia in August 2008, when there supposedly were peacekeepers on the ground from Russia, but there were separatists who opened fire on Georgian military positions. This is happening in eastern Ukraine as well right now. The Ukrainian leadership is withholding counterstrikes. The Georgian government did for a while, but then it did retaliate, and that prompted a full-scale Russian invasion of Georgia. So I think this is exactly what President Putin is trying to provoke again. He's talked about a military technological response if his demands are not met, but not an invasion. So what he's going to do is say, well, the Ukrainians fought back. We didn't invade. We were defending. We were defending against their assault on the separatist troops. So until that clears, until that crisis moment clears, it's an academic exercise to talk about more Normandy format discussions. And again, Russia claims it's not a party to the Minsk agreements. Then why in the world would it threaten an invasion and to kill tens of thousands of people, civilians, for the implementation of an obscure agreement to which it claims it is not a party? It's just the story does not hold together. But before we can get back to Normandy, you got to get past this moment of high military tension.
And Matthew, I guess one of the concerns would be that President Putin is using the Minsk agreements as a political tool. This must be something that Western countries are very worried about, right?
I hope they are. I mean, in a lot of, you know, discussions I listen to and have been involved with, I hear Europeans try to hold Ukraine's feet to the fire and say, you know, if you don't implement the Minsk agreements, suggesting perhaps Russia has a justification to try to force implementation. And that's a total red herring. Moscow does not care about the Minsk agreements. So I hope that throughout the NATO alliance, European leaders do recognize, Mohammed, just what you said, that the Minsk agreement really, again, the focus on it now is a red herring. What Russia is about now is, yes, as Mikhailo said, destabilizing Ukraine, preventing Ukraine from ever joining NATO. And I stand by what I said before, also relitigating the post-Cold War security framework, to which Russia agreed, by the way. It agreed in 1994 in the Budapest Memorandum to support Ukraine's territorial integrity and sovereignty if Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons. Ukraine lived up to its end of the bargain. Russia has violated as deeply as you could.
Andrei, the fact that the Minsk agreements are not legally binding, how much does that complicate this all?
Well, I think that it might open various avenues for the Russian leadership in Donbas. For instance, given the current escalation, I do not exclude a diplomatic recognition of the breakaway republics by Russia. And that would be, of course, a game changer. That would indeed make the situation in East Ukraine somewhat similar to what happened in Georgia back in 2008. And then I think the Minsk agreements will collapse. I don't think that the probability is very high, but I do not exclude that because, in my view, the State Duma would have never advanced such an idea if they had not received a nod from the Kremlin. So right now, I think this is probably a more likely challenge to the Minsk agreements than an invasion of Russia across the border with Ukraine. At least that's how I see the situation today. And for me, the most immediate task is to preserve the Minsk agreements, to avoid a diplomatic recognition of the breakaway republics, and to get back to the negotiating table. I don't think that we have other plausible options to reach any progress in de-escalating the situation.
Mykhailo, I'm curious to get your perspective on one thing. Most people say that the Minsk agreements have essentially been a failure from the outset. Have there been any successes that have come from them?
Well, look, there was an attempt to push through Parliament some changes to Ukraine's constitution. Those failed. But we do have one of the requirements, the political requirements of the Minsk agreement was to provide in Parliament a special law that provided more autonomy for those areas that are currently occupied. But one of the presumptions of that law for it to go forward was for the occupation to end. In other words, Russian troops leave, and then these areas become integrated into the rest of Ukraine as autonomous regions with their own police forces, with their own judiciary. In other words, significant amounts of autonomy. Those steps were made. However, at the end of the day, the military requirements of a full ceasefire and a withdrawal of Russian troops have never happened. And as a matter of fact, what we're seeing now is a further escalation and further advancement of Russian forces onto Ukraine's territorial integrity. I do want to say that, we're all hoping for peace. We're all hoping for some sort of a resolution to this. But at the end of the day, when President Biden comes out and says that the decision has been made and that Putin has made his decision, and the U.S. intelligence says that the decision to move in by Russian forces has been made, that makes it very, very difficult to even dream about any kind of a peaceful solution. At the moment, we're looking for de-escalation.
Mykhailo, you mentioned the hope for a peaceful solution. If there is a peaceful resolution to all that's going on right now, would there be any appetite in Ukraine for a Minsk-based settlement?
Look, I'm not sure that it needs to be Minsk-based. It could be any other, choose another city if you like. But the reality is that, yes, Ukrainians are interested in a settlement. Having said that, we are interested in also de-escalation on our borders. We are not interested in having Russian troops amass on our borders constantly. Secondly, the Donbas crisis and the fact that there is an occupation in eastern Ukraine should not be separated from the fact that there is an illegal annexation of Crimea that has happened. And Crimea has officially been now supposedly transferred to the Russian Federation. Well, that's problematic as well. So Russia has taken over 7% of our territory and continues to be threatening to take more. So looking at peaceful solutions, of course. But at the end of the day, I think Ukrainians understand today that the existential threat that Russia presents to Ukraine is long term. And we will have to deal with that long term. It's not something that's going to go away tomorrow for as long as the Putin regime remains in the Kremlin.
All right. Well, we have run out of time, so we're going to have to leave our conversation there. Thank you so much to all of our guests, Andrei Kortunov, Mykhailo Vinetsky and Matthew Bryza. And thank you, too, for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From me, Mohammed Jamjoum, and the whole team here, bye for now.